Hi, you're listening to a podcast of the best bits of The Breakfasters for the week ending Friday, 7th of August, broadcast live on Triple R from Melbourne, Wurundjeri Country, Australia.
Coming up on the pod, I question whether a first aid course is ever really worth the trouble, and the always delightful Alice Pung drops in to talk about the importance of reading and writing. Turns out, pretty important.
For Weird Science, Dr. Jen swipes up on scrolling, and the directing duo behind Wicker, Eleanor Wilson and Alex Fisher, join us ahead of their film premiering at MIFF. And finally, we investigate the merits of inviting AI to become a third in your relationship.
Independent Melbourne Radio 3RRR.
I have a theory about first aid. I don't know if you've done a first aid course. Whenever I've done one, it's been like for work or for school or something. So I think taking a first aid course is an obligation and teaching a first aid course is a mental illness. Have you? The amount of first aid teachers that have just been out of their minds every time. Mm-hmm. I did one and it was like this German lady was taking the course, and then when we did the scenario, it was like a car crash and she's like, this person's unconscious. And she put herself in the scenario and she said, and my arm has fallen off. And I was like, okay. And she's like, all right, go. And then so you're supposed to go to the unconscious person first in your triage. That's top. And I went to do that, but then she got in my face and she started screaming, my arm fell off. And then I was like, oh, okay. And I pretended to treat her, make believe. And then she went, nope, wrong. Oh. I was like, that feels like a trap. You guys scream in my face.
She's supposed to say, even if the person's screaming, you ignore them.
You ignore them. And say, I don't care that your arm's fallen off. This person is unconscious.
You are a lost cause.
Yeah.
Ah, good.
But
don't get bullied into helping.
Yes. And then I had the worst one I ever had is I had to do a course for work, and the guy that took it, it always happens in the scenarios. The scenarios is where they go off book. But he was doing these scenarios, right? The first one, he goes, okay, you're in a shopping center and there's a pregnant woman and she's collapsed. Mm. Okay. Do you use a defibrillator on her?
Good question.
Great question. And no other information. Is she breathing? Did she just fall over? Yeah. just do you want to electrocute her? And so we all had a little chat about it and we said, no, we're not going to use the defib. And he went, oh, okay, yeah, why's that? And we said, well, we're worried about the baby. And he said, that baby's dead.
Whoa.
And we were like, what? And he goes, yep, before she's even hit the ground, baby's gone.
Oh, an outside smiggle.
Yeah. As soon as the woman's unconscious, baby's dead. And I was like, well, that's not true. You've been pregnant. You didn't sleep for 9 months. Is that what happened?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, of course. As soon as you're unconscious.
Excuse me. No. I didn't even hit the ground.
You can't lie down. No. You cannot. You must stay standing.
Meanwhile, there's some bitch up there whose arm's fallen off.
Oh, yeah. Get out of my face, lady. I don't have time.
Absolutely.
Come back to me when you're unconscious. But he just like kept doing it. So he's like, all right, you failed that one, but I'll give you another chance, give you another scenario. He goes, all right, you've come across a car accident, okay? The driver, they're slumped over the steering wheel, and the passenger, they've gone through the windscreen. Mm. In the back seat is a baby.
Oh, wow.
Who are you going to check on first? And we knew it was coming. And it got really, like, pretty heated because everyone's like, well, I'm going to check on the baby. And he was like, baby's dead. Because no baby would ever survive a car accident. What are you talking about? That's why they have special seats.
Being in the seat till they're 8 years old.
How do you know if you don't check on it? One woman who was a mother got really upset and she said, she goes, well, as a mother, if my life was saved because someone didn't check on my baby, I would murder that person. So you tell me if it's the right thing to do. Mm. He's like,
good.
No,
yeah.
But yeah, but he said, if you check on the baby, you've wasted time. The whole car's dead.
Oh.
Mm. God, don't waste. Very pessimistic first aid person.
I know.
He
was a father, it turned out in the end. And then right at the last thing.
Not even bothering anyone of those stickers.
He's like, wait, do you need car seats? I've just been throwing my babies in the back bench seat and they roll around there. I'm wondering why they keep dying.
Forget the baby on board stickers. You're wasting your time. He and then the very last thing he did is he brought out the child CPR thing. And he was like, now this is how you do CPR on a child.
Oh, the little doll. Are you,
yeah. Why are we doing this?
Yeah, you already told me.
You already told me a baby can survive nothing.
But just for kicks.
Just for kicks.
Have so what, he gets out like baby's first defibrillator or whatever. Is that what it is?
You know, you get the...
It's got the wiggles on it.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like those little operation. Those sneakers that light up when they stomp around, when you put the defib on it. It has a little LED flash.
Sweet.
Wow. It's weird. The thing that's maybe the worst, apart from the fact that he's giving you mistruths, mm-hmm. is that he seems to get a real kick out of it, being like, you're all idiots, and I know the truth.
Oh, yeah. He's like,
and, like, I can imagine him standing on the sideline smoking a cigarette, watching a car accident, being like, I know what's happening in there, and I will not help. No one has ever survived an accident or a fall.
And it's not going to start.
I know this because I did a 3-day course.
I've got a cert 4.
Yeah, exactly.
Why you'd go, yeah. He worked with us as well. So he was on staff and then he had the qualifications for the first aid. So we had to like be around him after that.
Oh, he was a colleague.
He was a colleague, yeah. So,
okay.
Yeah. He was an army. He used to, his job was to date stamp the mail and then he would do it to the tune of I Will Rock You.
We Will Rock You.
We Will Rock You.
Just
that's
him.
It. Just
only
him.
He will
only,
rock you.
Only he will rock you. And good luck. But he was just like.
And would he sing? Buddy?
No singing, but everyone would ignore him and he would try so hard to get attention that one time he just went. In the middle of like a quiet office, people are just working. And as a grown man making fart noises with his mouth.
And
everyone ignored it.
Did the
That's
baby
how much
survive?
People didn't like
it. Wait, is it true that he had children?
Yeah.
Who's procreating with this man?
We don't know.
Oh. Yeah, she might be just as bad.
She might be. But I'll tell you what she didn't do, fall over.
No, of course not. Imagine the fart noises in an office. Mm. And did he get the attention? I mean,
no,
we're talking about
the
him on radio.
Thing,
this is his absolute dream.
Yeah, he won't be listening. But the saddest thing is no one flinched.
Mm.
Can you imagine that, making a fart noise with your mouth?
And even then,
people like, ignore you.
God, maybe I should have thought of something interesting to say. No, no, I'm going to make more noises from my mouth. Okay.
So is your theory maybe that... volunteering to run the first aid was a attention.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. So he gets the floor.
Yeah.
And he absolutely
loves to be an expert.
Oh.
Because I would have thought if he was really into first aid, his song of choice with the stamping would be Staying Alive. Isn't that the
That's what
that's the
thing.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, that's why maybe that's why everyone dies because he's too slow on the compressions. He's got the wrong beat.
He's doing clean.
Woo! That's right. Triple R.
Alice Pang is the best-selling author of 15 books, including Unpolished Gem, which this year was re-released with a special 20th anniversary edition, the memoir Her Father's Daughter, the essay collection Close to Home, and novels Lorinda and 100 Days, which was shortlisted for the Miles Franklin. The author, who in 2022 was awarded an Order of Australia Medal for services to literature, is taking the stage this week to present the E.W. Cole Lecture at the Wheeler Centre. And to tell us about the writer and literary proselytiser joins us now. Alice, welcome back to Breakfasters.
Thank you for having me back.
How exciting, this lecture. What do you know about E.W. Cole? Do you know anything about it?
I know a little bit about him. I know he was a bookseller in the 1880s. He had the biggest bookstore in the Southern Hemisphere, the Cole Bookstore. And he was also very much into, he was anti-war and he was against the White Australia policy. So it sounded like a fine dude.
Mm. I think he opened the bookstore on the day of the Melbourne Cup to give people something else to do.
Oh, I had no idea.
Wow, yeah. It's time.
Right. How did you settle on what you want to get off your chest
for this lecture? That's a good question. My friend Sian Lu, who won the Miles Franklin last year, talked about failure. And for those of you who, his speech is just phenomenal. So I've been around for a while as a writer, so I just thought I'd talk about doing it for 20 years, for two decades, you know what it means. Yeah.
Mm. So we've spoken about this previously, you go into schools and you teach about writing. What do some people not know this? What does writing unlock sometimes for people?
Oh, so when I go into schools, Daniel, often I ask the students, how many are on social media, even though there's a social media ban, but students always honest. So at least half of them will put their hands up. And I know there'll be plenty more who haven't put their hands up who are on social media. But I tell them that social media they think they're writing, but what they're doing is actually broadcasting, because they already have an audience of at least one person. When I started out, I had no audience. I just did it, and I kept a diary. So about 10 years ago, maybe 30% of the students kept diaries. 20 years ago when I asked, half of them. Now two or three people in a class of 50 or 60 will keep a diary. And it's a big difference between writing, knowing you have a public audience, and writing for concentrated periods of time, because when you sit with your thoughts, you find that they're not all that pleasant, as you portray. Yeah.
There was a feature in the New York Times that we were discussing about. It was talking to people who are writing AI slop and helping write it, and, you know, pumping out 7 biographies a week or whatever. And one of them said, writing doesn't make economic sense, which is why they do it. And I suppose you can't argue with that. It doesn't make economic sense to pursue this.
It doesn't. I was at my friend Dimet Divaroran's book launch last year, and she spent 7 years writing a book, and her husband was in the audience, and he said, "Nice job for 10 cents an hour." calculated how long it took. So it doesn't make financial sense. But I think it was last year I read that guy that people don't like, J.D. Vance's biography, Hillbilly Elegy. Writing is a direct connection to someone's thoughts, not what they say, but what they're thinking. And when you read someone's biography, Andre Agassi's, who else did I read, which is unexpected, Prince Harry's, you feel for the person. They become human to you. You understand where they're coming from. You can't demonise a person that you've spent 2 or 3 hours with.
Yeah.
Well, so you can, but it sounds like you don't.
Well, you've listened to epically. I mean, I think maybe they even had the same ghostwriter, Open and Spare, or whatever.
They do. Except I think Andre Agassi was more gracious about it. I could not have done this, and Prince Harry hid it from the world.
Exactly.
Did you ever read the ghostwriter writing back in the New York Times?
No.
He wrote back and said this was the worst job I ever had, and all the terrible things that he was put through by Prince Harry.
You'll
find it really compelling.
Okay, that's the first thing I'll be doing at 9 a.m.
Yes, please do.
What do you mean, keeping calm and carrying on, the title of the lecture?
Oh, you know, I started writing when I was young. I had low self-esteem. I didn't think I'd be published. I kept on writing, and then through all sorts of things, through the birth of my 3 children, my parents aging, the death of a sibling, just kept on at it at times when I thought it would be the end. Also, I thought my book, when it first came out, would maybe last for 6 months and be remanded for, in Andrew's Discount Books the book grocers. And it hasn't. It's lasted for 2 decades, which means that there is something enduring about it. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about talking? You can talk. You can talk off the cuff. Not every writer can speak. And I'm wondering about the role of writing amid the prevalence of the people listening to the written word.
And people doing TikToks.
That sort of thing.
I can't do that. I only learnt to talk because my book was put on high school curriculums, and I never assume that everyone has read my book. And in fact, I assume no one has read my book, especially if you have 200 year 9 boys and they have given you a moustache and a full beard on your back cover. these boys have not read my book, so if you can capture a year 9 audience for half an hour, I think you can actually talk okay to an adult audience.
Absolutely.
So I learnt this. I've never been able to talk. That's why I wrote. It was just on the job.
Are you a million miles from Stoicism? Or what do you think about Stoicism and the perseverance that you appear to be touching on maybe in this lecture?
Oh, I love you mentioned Stoicism. I, I didn't think about that. Maybe I'll put it in my lecture. I am Buddhist, so I guess that's where my writing philosophy comes from. You know, it's, I'm not sure I've given you this metaphor before, but your mind is like a glass of water with mud, and every day you're shaking it up. And when you sit down to write, you're letting that water settle, that glass, and all the mud sinks to the bottom, and then you see how much crap you have in there. You know, so that's what happens when I write. Yeah.
What do you do if it's mostly mud?
Oh, you leave it for a week or two, and then you look at it and you think, oh, I'll scrap all that, it's just crap. Yeah.
And we hear of, like, writers' residences and or residencies and going overseas and being in a cottage. It's occasionally this will come across someone's radar. But you can – do you think you can write anywhere?
I think so, because I grew up in a noisy household with three siblings, and cousins stayed over when they moved from overseas before they found their houses. And I've always been able to write anywhere with noise. I live in a residential college with 100 students. Sometimes there are parties going on. I've had the Good Weekend and a few magazines ask to profile my writing room as a beautiful feature for, you know, the Good Weekend. And every time I said, you can, but you don't want to. And they don't believe me until I show them pictures, because my writing desk is a $40 wheelie thing that you give to old people when they're in the bed to give them breakfast. And that's so that I could wheel it everywhere when I had babies that I was holding, and to be in rooms of my kids. It's not... it's pretty ugly. It's,
it's functional.
The craft of writing. Yeah, it's functional. So the advice I always give students, whether they're 8 or 80, is you just have to do it. In no other profession do you have accountants or aged care workers or childcare workers sit on a panel, you know, waxing lyrical about doing their craft. Yeah. Mm. And so writers get that. Mm. And then they talk and talk and they don't do the writing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you feel self-conscious talking about writing a little bit? Like it could be spent doing it instead of talking about it?
Oh, I like being around you guys. It's So I do enjoy teaching it, and I do enjoy a lot visiting the schools, because you can change a young person's perception of what they can be. So I've met a few English teachers that taught English because they saw someone like me, or they studied my books, like Asian Australian or African teachers. But, you know, sometimes it can be a bit of a wank fest. If and you're talking to audience.
Yeah, yeah. And so how do you keep it on the right side of wank?
Oh, I just don't talk about the burning candles. So I've had that question.
Okay.
What is, you know, what do you do? Do you burn candles? That kind of
thing. Yeah, you just like to do it.
Yeah, there's no magic to it. You just have to do it, don't you? It's the cheapest profession in the world. I always tell students, if you want to be a scientist, you need a lab. If you want to be a dancer, you need special shoes. If you want to write, you just have a cheap-ass 40-cent notebook and you can do it.
Yeah. What about expending intellectual energy on something that requires maybe writing, and then if you want to do some writing but it's like you just spent at the end of the day?
Oh, you are. Because I've worked in retail, I've worked in all sorts of jobs, and you are just spent. You just want to write you just want to watch Netflix, you know? The Kardashians and things like that. So that's why writing is still quite a middle class profession. You need time and you need the intellectual breathing space. You can't be stressed about rent, and you can't be stressed about bullying at work or whatever happens in a person's lifetime. Yeah.
Mm.
So it's really important for me that I go into the outer suburbs and give writing workshops and tell people you can do it through the adversity. Sometimes it helps, you know, going through a rough patch at work and you're writing it down means that you've let it out.
Mm. Author memoirs, do you enjoy reading them? I was flicking through the George Orwell's Why I Write. And
I love that.
And I was thinking about you, and I'm wondering, is this a genre that you spend a bit of time in, like thinking about writers and writing, and instead of, you know, necessarily exploring stories, but when it's like a dog eating its own vomit.
Oh, no. Oh, I love how you explained it like that. I read memoirs, but I read everything. So I read a lot of crime novels because it's like not eating vomit, but going to a restaurant and ordering the dish that you can't make at home yourself. I can't write crime. I think it's brilliant,
yeah,
people who do. But I read memoirs, and you might have noticed I mentioned three men, three powerful white men. It's because I think it's really interesting to get into the thoughts of someone so different from myself that it's really easy to dislike that person, but you just really can't if you spend 3 or 4 hours with Prince Harry or even, you know, the terrible vice president. You just see them as a human being making pretty bad decisions, yeah, at the moment. But then there's hope because they can make different decisions. They have in the past.
Mm. We have smashed up into the news. I was wondering also, just if you were following Anthony Fauci, and his diaries have been kind of released. And it's like, wow, he's written a lot.
Wow.
I mean, they're not in book form. Their email's leaked. But anyway, just in terms of keeping the diary writing and journal entry craft alive. But there's more of Alice Pung that you can catch on stage. You'll on stage on Thursday delivering the lecture. Thursday, 6th of August, 6:30 at the Wheeler Centre. And then there's a conversation after?
Yes. Yes.
That'll be fun.
That will, with my friend Marina, who owns the Amplified Bookstore.
Oh.
Yes.
Gorgeous. All right. Well, what a beautiful way to spend an evening. And you can find out more on the Wheeler Centre website. Alice Pung, it's always a great pleasure having you in studio.
Triple R on FM, digital, online and via the app.
Weird Science with Living Dopamine Dispenser, Dr. Jen. Morning, Dr. Jen.
Morning.
Good morning, my friends. So I've got a little scenario for us all. Mm-hmm. No judgment, but just can you picture yourself here? You wake up, you check your phone, and you discover an order confirmation for something that you have probably almost no memory of actually buying, something that you don't need, not even something you necessarily want, but you bought it late at night, kind of, you know, half asleep, mid-scrolling, and then, you know, the next morning you're looking at your phone thinking, what did I do that for? Like, why did I buy that? I don't want that crap. So I don't need any, you know,
Confessions.
Mm-hmm. But I think we can all kind of relate to that, yes?
Yeah.
Yep. Mm. You know, was it a jumper? Was it a gadget? Was it a, you know, speaking for a friend? So I want to tell you about this new study that I found that gives the, I think it's a slightly unsettling answer, but also a good answer because it takes the pressure off us, that according to this new study, the answer is, what were you thinking? Well, you actually weren't thinking at all, or at least not with the kind of careful, sceptical, analytical part of your brain, and that it's not a personal failing. You guys know I love to come in here and say, it's not your fault you did this thing, and this study is a really good example of that. So this study, which is ridiculously simple, and I'll tell you what they did in a minute, but it basically turns out that the very act of scrolling through our social media feeds puts our minds into a state where we are measurably easier to sell to. So the ads haven't necessarily got cleverer. It's not that the marketers out there are suddenly having, you know, whole new approaches to doing it. It's just that our defences have got weaker.
That makes, because I feel like the ads have gotten worse.
Probably. Well,
I feel like they used to put more effort in.
And probably that's because they realise they don't need to, right? So this research pins down what's going on. So these were researchers at the University of Tennessee, and they showed people two versions of the same ad. One version made this very explicit, confident claim, essentially saying, the facts are clear, we are the best, you should buy this. The other version of the ad, so for the same product, and the products here were laundry detergent, phone cases and water bottles. Mm-hmm. So the second version of the ad made a more implicit claim. It basically laid out the information but left you as the buyer to make your own conclusion. So essentially, you know, here are the facts, you decide. Now, when people in the study viewed those ads in a normal, relaxed state, of course they preferred the second one, right? Mm-hmm. We want to be trusted to make up our own minds. You know, I'm a smart, discerning shopper. Tell me the facts and I'll decide whether I want to buy this thing or not. The pushy, we're the best version, came across as too much. People didn't like it. Mm-hmm. Then they changed one little thing. All they changed was that they had people scroll on Instagram for not half an hour, not an hour, 30 seconds. People scrolled on Instagram for 30 seconds and their preference flipped. After 30 seconds of scrolling on Instagram, now people favoured the confident ad, the one that just said, buy this, we're the best, trust me. Same people, same ads. The only thing that changed was that they'd been scrolling first. Which does my head in, right?
Wow. Yeah.
That's kind of crazy. So I guess the engine behind what's going on is something we've talked about in here quite a few times, which is cognitive load. So the idea being that your capacity for kind of really careful, effortful thinking isn't unlimited. It's, you know, you can use the analogy of it's a phone battery. It's this finite pool of mental energy and you draw down on it during the day. And so cognitive load is the demand that you're putting on that battery at any moment. And so when your cognitive load is low, you've got plenty of capacity to weigh things up, question their claims. Are you really the best? What evidence do you have that you're the best? And you notice when you might be being scammed or conned. But when the cognitive load for other things is really high, that capacity is already, you know, it's already taken up, it's already spoken for, and your brain starts to look for shortcuts. And the striking bit is, you know, you might think it takes something big, a crisis, a really stressful day, to get you to the point that you can't think carefully and critically anymore. But this study shows that 30 seconds of scrolling on Instagram is enough to measurably tire your thinking and shift how you respond. Like, it's just insane, right?
Wow. So do we know, is that by design on their part or is it just...
Well, I mean, I think it's just the way we've all kind of accepted that social media works. Like, I think... Like, think about what your brain is actually doing when you're scrolling, right? In the space of a minute, you are what? You're processing a message from a close friend, then you're looking at a stranger's holiday photos, then you're hearing about your cousin's new baby, then you're hearing some really distressing world news about war on the other side of the planet, then, you know, you get a message from a friend you went to high school with that you haven't seen for 20 years. Like, it's each little individual bit of news is almost inconsequential and kind of really easy to manage. But they all take a different mental gear, I suppose. Like, you're kind of your, it's a different emotional response. It's a different level of trust. It's a different context. Like, these researchers argue that our social media feeds are actually one of the most cognitively demanding things you can engage with, just because it's such a jumble and you're jumping from happy to sad to confused to jealous to FOMO to you know, like, it's just really, really demanding. And so engaging with social media is exhausting.
So is that, you know, I kind of, as you're speaking, it just a little spark in my head kind of came out where is this why so many men or boys are persuaded by people, characters like Andrew Tate?
Yeah, Dr. Chen.
As opposed to, like, if you saw someone like Andrew Tate at the bar, you would think he's such a douchebag. You know what I mean?
100%.
But then if you're seeing him on your feed, you're just like, oh. Confidence.
He's a human version of one of those ads.
Cumulatively, our feeds are draining our cognitive loads really fast, and the platforms are designed that way, I reckon, Bron. They're absolutely designed that way. You know, features like infinite scrolling and auto-playing, like, we are being played by big social media to keep us in that state for as long as possible, because then, yes, we are susceptible to misinformation. We are susceptible to people selling us things. We're susceptible to all of these messages out there that in the cold, hard light of day when we were thinking more clearly, we might say, well, come on, that's clearly crap. I don't buy that for a second. And I think like, I think one of the really good analogies here is think about how you react to a very assertive kind of take charge person, right? On a normal day, if you're feeling relaxed, you've got capacity, you're clear-headed, someone who's really pushy and bossy can come across as arrogant, and your mm-hmm. response might be, you know, who put you in charge, my friend? Like, get out of my face. But then picture yourself in a crisis, right? You are really stressed, you're feeling low in capacity, in agency. At that point, when something's gone wrong and you're overwhelmed, if somebody, you know, and you don't know what to do, when somebody assertive comes in and says, all good, don't worry, this is what we're doing, it's going to be fine, it's a relief, it's a lifeline, right? Yeah. And so the whole point is that the person, you haven't changed, but your state of being has changed. And so if social media can put us into that crisis mode where we're overwhelmed and just kind of struggling to cope with all of the information that's coming at us, we become the person who's kind of in crisis, who just says, you take charge, you tell me what to think, and I'll believe you. You know, you tell me that this is the best choice I can make. You tell me to believe that with you, my life's going to be better, or by purchasing this thing, I'm going to be better. You know, it's, yeah, and I guess if you, does anyone remember Daniel Kahneman,
no,
I think?
No.
So he was a Nobel Prize winner, and he was the one who made famous this whole idea of two systems of thinking, so slow thinking and fast thinking. So system one thinking is kind of very fast, automatic, kind of gut feelings, you know, quick judgments, whereas system two thinking, according to him, is very slow and deliberate and analytical. And that's the part of thinking that you use to kind of check claims and, you know, do the sums, notice the scam. And he's always argued that system two is very powerful, and it's expensive, and your brain really avoids firing it up unless you really have to.
Cognitively expensive.
Exactly. And so when you're under cognitive load, by, for example, being engaged with your social media feed, system two is too deleted or too busy to kind of come online. And so that's when system one takes the wheel, and system one is always just looking for shortcuts. And so one of the most reliable shortcuts we have is that if someone is confident, they are credible. And so if someone says boldly, you know, without hesitation, this is what you should be thinking or doing or buying, yeah, you know, this is the vulnerability that these ads are exploiting. We can't do the cognitively difficult, exhausting, careful, critical thinking. We fall into the trap of looking for shortcuts, and when an ad tells us, I'm the best, buy me, your life will be better, you know, we do it. It's not our fault.
The more we know, the more tools we have to resist or at least be aware of our own behaviour, the more likely we can uncheck ourselves.
I think the thing to know is that this whole trap is the collision of a depleted brain and an instant kind of buy now button, and they're right next to each other, right? Mm. So the thing we all have within our capacity to do is to insert time. So if you're scrolling and you're half distracted late at night and a brand says, you need me, the answer is to just put it on pause and come back tomorrow. And if you really need it, then you'll know that tomorrow. Yeah. And I think the broader lesson is that, you know, we tend to think that persuasion is about, I guess, the strength of the argument, but this research suggests actually it's about the state of the audience.
It's just about wearing someone down.
Yeah. So if you know, the most powerful thing an advertiser can do isn't necessarily to craft a better claim. It's to catch you at the exact moment that you have no energy or capacity to question their claim. Mm-hmm. And knowing that is the whole defence. So if you see something that's uber confident and you're tempted to go, clearly you know what you're talking about, just ask yourself, actually, am I quite tired? Because if I'm quite tired, maybe I just shouldn't listen and I should trust myself.
Don't add to cart in your pyjamas.
Well, exactly. I think that is a rule to live by, Daniel. I think we should just all remember that and life would be better.
Beautiful. Dr. Jen, you can spoon and feed us our opinions anytime.
Excellent. Did you notice how confident I sounded?
Thank you. Triple R.
Alex Fisher and Eleanor Wilson are writers and filmmakers whose filmography includes science fiction comedy Save Yourselves, which premiered at Sundance, as well as, between them, a swag of award-winning short films, wildly successful music videos and feature documentaries. And now the co-directors are in town for Wicca, the cheeky twist on a period love story, and that kicks off the Melbourne International Film Festival tonight with more screenings to come. And to tell us about it, the acclaimed directors and real-life Tinder success story joins us now. Alex and Eleanor, welcome back, bastards.
Wow, you did your research.
tonight, it's a big day. It's fun.
Yeah, we're very excited to be here. We're a little tired.
It's going to be a long day.
Oh, really?
But for us, it's 2 p.m., so we're jacked up.
Oh, really? Yeah. Where have you been?
Well, we came from L.A.
You came from L.A. Yeah. Okay.
Just yesterday.
Yeah, full on. And now, so tonight, you'll be... There's a lot of screens at Hoyt's.
Yeah. I think the film is playing in 9 screens.
Simultaneously, basically.
Yeah, I thought it was going to be 1 screen, and then it was going to be 4, and then now it's 9.
Yeah, it's very exciting.
That's a big party.
So you'll be dragged from screen to screen.
Yeah.
I think there's going to be someone pulling us. Yeah.
Yeah, right. And now, what's it like to see a wild film like this with a live audience?
It's always fun.
It's very fun, yeah. I mean, it's a comedy, right? So we love seeing comedies with a big bunch of people because it just makes the experience so much more
exciting.
When we did the test screenings, we wanted to sit in the middle because we wanted to hear all the people breathing and chatting, and people talk to the screen during
the
movie.
It's very exciting.
Wow.
Yeah. Test screenings are the best. I mean, it's the only way to sort of know. You've got to get in there and be like, does this joke land or not?
Is this laugh funny or is this like an audible smile funny?
Yeah.
Wow. Now, Olivia Colman, who's in this film, said is one of the top 3 scripts she's ever read.
Yeah, she surprised us when she said that.
Yeah.
When she lied about it.
Because you thought it would be number 1.
Yeah. Like, obviously, it's better than Tyrannosaurus. Yeah.
But it appears it's attracted a cast, I suppose, because they're drawn to its weirdness.
I think so. And Olivia's the magnet. So when she signed on, it legitimized the project and everybody was excited to work with her.
Yeah.
And she's the type of person who signs on to a movie based on the script alone and not the, you know, never heard of him directors.
Yeah, exactly. We're lucky. But Alexander definitely, I think, leans into the weird.
Skarsgård.
Big time. He doesn't think twice about it.
Yeah. Mm.
Well, and it's adapted from an Ursula Wills Jones short story. I think having read the story, it's charming and vivid in its kind of bluntness.
Yes, it's very straightforward. Mm. It's very sparse. There's a lot of humor in it, and we just kind of took every morsel of it and dug in.
Love that.
Yeah, it was fun. I mean, there's so few lines of dialogue in the short story. It's really sparse, as Al said, but it was just these little clues, you know, like you just says something about the next morning.
After a beautiful night of their first marriage, I can't remember exactly what the line is.
He offers to rebuild the bed, you know, and it's like,
it's just that sentence, one sentence. And so we read that and we said, well, we should see all of that.
Let's take away all innuendo and just put it on screen.
Okay. Yeah. So to spell it out, we've got a fisher woman who turns up to Peter Dinklage. And now, no one has names, is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
They're their job.
She gets a husband made for her, basically, who's made of wicker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
okay. That's
exactly.
Right.
And hilarity ensues.
exactly, as it would.
Well, he's so beautiful.
Yes.
And they have kind of a beautiful romance, so everyone freaks out.
Mm.
That's the fun part.
Well, was there anything laborious about creating an actual wicker man?
Absolutely, yeah. We took about 18 months of R&D to really get him looking as beautiful as he did.
The thing about creating a face that looks like a real face is if you get anything a tiny bit wrong, it's very weird right away.
Yeah.
So the amount of work that went into making him beautiful and look like Alexander and having the facial prosthetic match his facial expression was incredibly detailed and painstaking.
And also...
But we didn't have to do it. Somebody else did it.
That was quite a workshop.
And then you just turned up and said, not good enough.
Actually, yeah.
Well, the tricky thing was that we didn't get him into the suit until, like, the Friday before we were starting to shoot on Monday. That was the first time Alexander actually wore the suit. And so up until then, it had just been fitted on his, you know, life cast or on someone else at wedding.
With
someone
with a similar face, but not the same face.
Which looks very weird. Not handsome.
It bizarrely looked like Owen Wilson.
Yeah. For a time there, it looked a bit like Owen Wilson on someone
It was amazing. It just looked like, Owen Wilson.
You had to go back to Alex.
It's like Hannibal Lectering the suit. Yeah. And then it just comes out Owen Wilson. It was amazing.
You just have to recast the role because you're like, sorry, the suit looks like Owen Wilson. You're going to have to get it in.
Yeah.
Yeah,
we can't read this.
Definitely, when Alexander was wearing Alexander's face, it looked like Alexander, so it was okay.
Thank God.
I remember the film The Shape of Water, and there's like an interspecial romance, I suppose. But here it gets a little bit more full on.
There's one part which it's not a line of dialogue, and I'll show you guys this that she does like in
finger,
Shape of Water.
A finger to hand gesture to illustrate how sex happens between them.
Yeah.
And it's so good. And that was something
that was kind of like a tonal inspiration. Just that one moment in that film, it was like, oh, they went there.
Like, and that movie paved the way. And you know, there's all these movies that sort of paved the way for this to be able to be made.
Yeah, right.
That's one of them.
Yeah. And your relationship. I don't want to stretch the truth or over egg this, but were you basically intimacy stand-in coordinators?
We had an amazing intimacy coordinator, but. Fun fact, we did, because we had, you know, every actor has stand-ins when you're lighting that, you know, while they're getting their makeup done, their stand-ins lighting. But, you know, our stand-ins...
They're like, we're not doing that.
Well, we asked them, we're like, do you feel comfortable, you know, like our intimacy coordinator, would you sit astride him? And they were just like, And we're like, we'll do it. So Alex and I actually did.
So we did a lot of standing in blocking ourselves, It's good to be married directors sometimes.
Yeah.
Comes in handy.
Yeah.
Block the sex scenes.
So, well, you know, it was a collaborative creative effort between the five of us, between Olivia, Alex, and Ita, and us.
Yeah.
Oh my god. And what's your approach to comedy, both of you? Do you have a shared sensibility? Is that what attracted you both
Yeah,
I think we share the same taste, but we have different sort of strengths or ways of going about it.
Yeah, right? But we have we have a similar sense of humor, I think.
Yeah.
And we watched, when we were writing, do you guys know Blackadder?
Of course I do.
I'm American. Eleanor introduced me to Blackadder, and I call it Blackadder.
Yeah.
And that was the fun, that was definitely...
We were watching that as we were writing the first draft of the screenplay. Wow. Just for absorption of British dialogue and a sense of humor and that kind of stuff.
And having the freedom to be nuts.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, just go for it. And when we write together, we try to make each other laugh and impress each other. So we really go for it.
What about music video? Can I ask about your music video past?
Yeah.
Yeah. Was there anything that informs, or what do you learn? Run through some of your favorite ones that you've maybe been involved in.
I don't know. I always did a different thing, but there was always some kind of visual element to it. So it's usually kind of DIY and something kind of special. So one was, the first one I did was a stop motion, but with real people. So you take a picture, then move them, then take a picture, then move them.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. And I just always loved doing something experimental visually. And with music videos, you can do that. And there's a built-in audience, with the fans of the band. And so it's just an amazing way to experiment. And I don't know, when you get to make a movie, you're like, well, how else can we experiment?
Mm. Mm-hmm. And Eleanor, what about your inclination towards experimentation?
Good question. I mean, we just really, I think Alex and I as a pair, Alex comes from this sort of comedy and music video background, and the short films that I had made prior to working together were more dramatic with a little bit of comedy.
Eleanor was trying to make serious films.
Yeah, I was. Yeah. Whoops. But I think that's the thing that kind of brought us together, and the intersection of where our films kind of land is in this space of really silly but also really grounded. And I think that's what we love about Wicker, is that it does kind of get crazy, but it's always hopefully coming from a place of relatability with all the characters. We always think that, you know, it's one thing to make fun of people, but also if you're kind of making fun of yourself at the same time, that's when the comedy gets really
good. Way funnier. Yeah.
Mm. And in the short story, I think the fish woman straight out of the gate described as ugly, perhaps?
It is. She's just called the ugly girl.
Yeah.
No, we're not going to call her the ugly girl.
We changed her name to Fisherwoman.
Yeah. And Olivia Colman...
Ugly girl's a job too.
That's true. Yeah.
But Olivia Colman, what do we know about ego and not having one and how that helps the creative process?
She's incredible. I mean, it really helps with the on-set vibe as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had it's quite a big ensemble cast and of really amazing, British comedy folk, alt comedy people. And, you know, everyone looks up to Olivia because she comes from both comedy and she can do all the dramatic stuff. And
Peep Show and the sketch stuff before she got into, Tyrannosaur and the drama side of it.
Yeah, but she just has no ego. She's just very chill on set, and she sets a tone for everyone of kind of no fuss, which is just such a gift.
She's kind of anti-fuss.
Anti-fuss, in fact. Yeah.
If there's fuss, it's got to end.
Yeah. That's true.
And then so there's further screenings at the Astor as well.
Yeah, so excited about that one. That's, I mean, I used to have that poster on the back of my toilet door, as everyone did.
Why not? And what about Adelaide? Have you been to Adelaide while you're in Australia, or
we're going over for a bit in the middle of the festival?
Because your family's from Adelaide. Family.
That's right. Yeah. Okay.
And we did a lot of post in Adelaide for the movie we did. We did VFX and sound.
Yeah,
so we spent some time in Australia last year.
Is that how you get the light comes through Peter's...
Exactly. That's right.
Okay, and that's VFX. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So they took a scan, a 3D scan of him in the outfit, and then sort of inverted it to give you the backing of what... Because when you see through a wicker basket, you see the other side of it. So they had to create that, and then they put the light through it, and we used a lot of lighting references, and they did an incredible job.
Yeah, it was really amazing. I mean, the practical effect is obviously the showstopper, but there's a lot of really subtle VFX throughout the movie that just kind of give it that extra layer of life and remind you sort of his fragility. And they nailed it.
Yeah, and you must be both
Kojo
sick of Wicker. Not the film, but the actual
the material.
The material. No, I can't get enough.
Yeah. Right, that's what we want.
Beautiful. Well, we're very happy you're in town. Alex Fisher and Eleanor Wilson are co-directors of Wicker, which is the opening night gala film for the Melbourne International Film Festival tonight. And there are additional screenings, even at IMAX.
Yeah.
I know. We're going to see it for the first time in IMAX.
Yeah.
Big screen.
That's so cool. Oh, that's awesome. Wicker is the name of the film. Head to miff.com.au for more information. And Alex and Eleanor, great pleasure to have you in the studio.
Thanks.
It's amazing to be here. We listen to Triple R from LA.
We do. We love
legend.
It.
Legend.
Triple R.
Just when you thought a tech company couldn't make you mad, any more mad, they've done it again. Sorry to talk about AI again, but I am forever shocked with what they think we can outsource to AI. But there's just been an ad online. It's copped a lot of backlash. And there's a company that is promoting an AI assistant that helps your relationship.
Mm.
So it is like you're in this weird little throuple with the AI bot.
I saw this ad.
Yeah, with the girl. Yeah, the guy, like, the boyfriend forgets the anniversary and she tells the bot, like, oh, he's forgot again. And the bot's like, oh, leave it with me. I'll sort it out. And then the bot goes back to the boyfriend and is like, hey, it's your anniversary.
Hey, you big dum-dum.
Yeah, and then it's like,
how does it do that? How does it talk to the boyfriend?
It's in
both. It sends it messages.
Yeah, so it's like in your messages, in your calendar, in your emails.
In your brain.
In
the bedroom.
It tells the boyfriend, I've booked it makes a reservation and then is like, I've also ordered these flowers. These are a favorite. And the boyfriend's like, oh, are they? And then the bot says, you just turn up and you act like it was all your idea. And then the bot's like a little snake and it goes back to the girlfriend and says, I organized everything. He thinks it's his idea.
And the girlfriend's and in on it too. And
she's
that's
it.
In the ad.
Yes.
What? And then the weird thing is because then the girlfriend is like pretending to the boyfriend, oh, wow, thanks for thinking of this. But everybody knows that he hasn't.
Everybody knows. She's
lying.
Telling her friends. Yeah. There's a little scene in the ad where she's chatting with a mate, being like, don't worry. I'll sort it out, whatever the company's name is.
Yeah, it's got some.
And they're like, are you
name.
Sure? We're talking about Sam here, and he's a big dumb idiot. And then it all works out. And he's so confident at the dinner table. He's like, hey, babe.
Hey, babe, I got your flowers. The bot told me.
I got you your favourite flowers.
But he's being exposed as a liar.
Yeah, but he doesn't know he's
been
exposed.
But he cares enough to download an app.
He has got the app on his phone.
Yeah, I don't know what's wrong with this.
I guess you wouldn't need to know anyone's passwords then. You could just chat to the AI and be like, hey, can you read my boyfriend's messages? Is he cheating on me?
Oh, this is another good thing to foster a good relationship.
Yeah, it's really good. It is. The whole ad is like, do you and your boyfriend hate each other?
Or has your boyfriend given up on anything
you're
trying? And do you think that is good enough?
Are you happy with this? Do you want to? What if you spoke to a robot and then that robot spoke to your boyfriend and then you never spoke to each other ever again? Would that be good for your relationship? Would you like that?
Oh, my, yeah.
I mean, there used to be the letters to the, like, Take Five magazine, or was it Mirror Mail? Or, you know, basically stories of, like, shit husbands. But, like, it's adorable.
Oh, yeah.
In the
yeah.
end, somehow. Or, like, maybe if you just get it on
the intention
chest.
Was there.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the good intention was there, whereas this guy's just like, I'm tired. Yeah. Get the Mrs. Flowers and shut up.
Yeah.
Why doesn't she want to put out?
Yeah, what if the robot did everything?
Yeah.
The robot did what you wanted. I don't know what would make you happy.
Yeah. She's never happy.
But it's a schmick ad. Mm. Like if you see beyond the
bit of Valerie playing in the background. Yeah.
Look, I mean, we're heading that. People are doing it anyway, aren't they?
Yeah. They've seen it. There's a gap in the market. There's a want for it for sure. People are using Claude to tell their kids bedtime stories.
Is that real?
Are they? Yeah.
Yeah. Great.
Oh, God. I don't know. Like
they put the kid in it? Like, yeah, tell me a story about...
Well, Andy Griffiths already did that.
Yeah, well, Andy Griffiths has written stories for your kids.
Well, that is outrageous. Mm. I mean, if people are actually doing that, holding the phone up to the kid's ear while it reads plagiarized story.
Yeah, well, I feel like I've heard that.
Oh, my God.
Or maybe they'll get it. They'll get the bot to write it and then they read it out. I don't know.
I mean, it's just funny to get like your parents reading you a story in bed, and that they did also read the prompt. Write a story about not that bit.
Here is a story in a more casual, whimsical tone.
Well, unbelievably, there was that Canadian MP last month.
Incredible! I love that video.
Right, he reads the whole thing. So he reads. He's got obviously got AI to write a speech for him,
or his assistant did it.
Well, his speechwriter, who's obviously getting paid way too much money. And then AI has said, which they could do, here's that, but said again in a more casual tone or something like that. But he reads that prompt and then reads the next version of the same speech and doesn't blink. Like,
here's a more natural, flowing version of that section that reads like a legislative speech rather than a series of short points. And he said that out loud, didn't miss a beat. No one's got their brain switched on.
You don't need to because this bot will do it for you. No, you do need to,
otherwise you'll suffer later in life and you'll suffer every day.
No, they'll make a new bot problem.
There's a bot for that.
There's a bot.
I was looking over the shoulder of someone on the tram playing Wordle.
Yeah. They didn't use a bot to do that.
No, Wordle. They didn't, but I was thinking that that's one way that people use their own brains.
Yeah.
And I was like, I want to help this guy. It was like 15 stops, maybe. Mm-hmm. It was ages.
And I hadn't got it.
And he was circling around. Anyway, whatever. But I really wanted to reach in there like Claude.
No. Have you tried an E?
Check your white flowers too while you're at it.
You're on Claude. Should I help this guy with Wordle? Claude, absolutely not, Daniel. Sit down.
Takes the fun of it. I mean, it's not AI, but I do remember doing pub trivia once and it was like a guess the song round. Mm. And there was a table of girls there who just used Shazam for everything. I'm like, well, what's the point of doing trivia?
You can't do that.
My knowledge is wasted here.
Everyone must have turned on them.
Oh, I don't know.
Famously.
That's the MC's job to...
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a bit of a nuts trivia. But yeah, I remember seeing them just do Shazam for all of it. And I was like, cool, well, that sounds like a fun game. Why don't you just go to the pub and have a chat?
Well, people don't like...
You don't have to do trivia.
I suspect people don't like getting things...
wrong.
Yeah, and to not know something, and not just knowledge, but to not know how to behave with your girlfriend is uncomfortable. And people cannot sit with that discomfort. Mm. And that discomfort is actually how you learn and grow and get better as a person. And so
the entire world is going to be in a state of arrested development from here on out.
We're done.
I think you should use the bot. I mean, Liz is away.
I should just chat with the bot.
Yeah, you could have been chatting with the bot. I can't be bothered to asking Liz what it happened on a trip. Can you look at her social media and tell me some questions to ask her? People would do this.
People would do it. Yeah. People do. A friend of mine saw someone on the tram fighting, like, with their girlfriend on the phone and then went, I can't do this over the phone anymore. And then hung up and then straight onto ChatGPT to be like, advice on what to say. And then the fight went on to text. And the bot's in there.
It's real for your friend to witness that. Oh, I would love to be there.
It was in the group chat. It blew up. There's photos coming back and,
Great
stuff.
Yeah, that is good. But I wonder if the person out there under the phone could tell. Like, they're just going to get on the bots now. They're just going to ask AI.
Because you're like, they've never spoken like this in their life. Yeah. When has he ever used the word pivot? What is this?
What if there's so when sex robots kick off, will you have to defer to your thruple other robot to talk to your sex robot?
You'll need a couples therapy bot. Yeah,
this, yeah, moist silicon thing wants flowers.
How do I clean sex robots?
You've got to buy another robot.
You've got to buy another robot.
Melbourne's own Triple R.
Thanks for listening to the Best Bits of Breakfasters. Catch us live on Triple R every weekday morning from 6 till 9 a.m. or listen on demand at rrr.org.au or on the Triple R app. You can get in touch with us via Instagram, Facebook or the Triple R website.